From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we take a look at news and events in the Latin America and Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, beginning with the renegotiation of NAFTA, which was one of President Trump's campaign promises.
The NAFTA renegotiation that President Trump has insisted on is supposed to begin in September. Now, and they're hoping that they'll be able to wrap it up before the Mexican presidential elections, which are in July next year. And I don't know when are the U.S. legislative elections? Are they also at the
next
end of
November,
next year?
November of 2018. They have midterms, they call them, yeah.
Yeah, so they're going to try and work to a timetable that reaches some kind of conclusion before next year, mid-2018. Mm. But I think that's very ambitious, given the differences of opinion that exist.
Yeah.
But because each side wants different things, and people in the States probably know very well what the North American Free Trade Agreement has entailed ever since it was, when was it, 1994 that it was negotiated?
It was in the 90s, yeah. It was... it had been negotiated by the Bush administration first then taken over and signed by Clinton. And Clinton took office in January 20th of 1993. So I think it was within a year or so of that they put the finishing touches on it and signed it and had the big ceremonies and all of that. And it was one of the campaign issues. If you'll remember, there was a third-party candidate,
Ross Perot.
Yeah, Ross Perot, who made NAFTA a big issue, and he was saying essentially that what has happened would happen in terms of the loss of jobs and in the United States and the destruction of the agricultural sector in Mexico, the small farm agricultural sector in Mexico.
Yeah, well, it's been a disaster for Mexican agriculture. But and I've been reading a little bit around the proposed talks that are supposed to start in September. I think they're scheduled to take place in Washington. And one of the figures that I came across was that, in general, people seem to think that there has been more employment that could be attributed in the United States to the NAFTA agreement, but the downside is that those jobs are jobs in which people generally earn 20% or more less than they used to.
Right.
So, and it's kind of promoted a low wage economy in the United States.
Right. I mean, the kind of jobs you've seen, for example, automobile workers' jobs that were high paying union jobs here, went offshore, including to Mexico, and now the goods that come in from China and Mexico and elsewhere that go into the stores here that are low cost or lower cost goods sold at Walmart, there's jobs now for people that used to be auto workers basically to sell that stuff at Walmart for a lot less money than they were making before.
Right.
I mean, that's, a caricature of it, but that's the kind of, it's illustrative of what has happened to the economy generally.
Yeah, and the suggestion that it's been beneficial for people in Mexico is completely counterfactual as well, because in Mexico, the figures that I've read reckon that wage levels have dropped 9% since NAFTA.
Right. I mean, what's happened there? It's been better for people in Mexico in that if you consider life in the United States better than life in Mexico, it's forced them to relocate to the United States to follow the money that was sucked out of their economy back here.
Right. Yeah, and as you said earlier, and the Mexican small farmer economy, which was the backbone of Mexico's domestic food production, has just been wiped out
by American agribusiness. Yeah, by U.S. agribusiness, in essence. That's the big one of the big winners.
Yeah. So, What Mexico is trying to do, and what the United States are saying, what the negotiators on the United States side are saying, is that they want a more balanced and reciprocal trade agreement. They want to make NAFTA more balanced and reciprocal. And what the context in which they're saying that is that when in the first years of NAFTA, the U.S. trade balance with Mexico they had a trade surplus with Mexico of $1,300 million,
right,
roughly, and that's turned in the last few years that's turned into a deficit of 64 million.
Right.
64 billion.
Right, 64 billion. Yeah.
64 billion. So they've gone from a surplus of 1.3 billion to a deficit. Sorry, what's 1,000 million?
1,000 million is a billion.
Yeah, okay. So is what they had a surplus of 1.3 billion, and that's turned into a deficit of 64 billion, right, which is a massive change.
Yes, sir.
And so that's the background of President Trump's efforts to renegotiate NAFTA. Now, and but while the U.S. negotiators are saying that they want a more balanced and reciprocal trade agreement, so much for free trade, by the way.
Yeah.
Then Mexico are saying that they want to preserve and strengthen the existing NAFTA agreement, and that looks like two completely contradictory objectives.
Right.
So then I don't know much about U.S. Trade with Canada, but from what I've been reading, apparently Canada, the U.S. is fed up with Canada because they feel that Canada takes advantage of the arbitration rules on dumping, the so-called Chapter 19 of NAFTA. And so that's another element that's likely to make the proposed calendar of the negotiations really quite unrealistic.
Yeah.
So we'll just have to see how that pans out. And the reason that people here in Central America are interested in how the NAFTA negotiations turn out is that although it's a much smaller it's an agreement, the CAFTA agreement, the Central American Free Trade Agreement with the United States has a much smaller impact on the United States. It's still quite important in terms of employment, especially here in Nicaragua. Because I remember when back in 2005, when the negotiations were going on under Robert Zoellick, who was then the U.S. Trade Representative, very aggressive representative of U.S. trade interests, and who explicitly linked trade to political and geopolitical considerations, kind of putting pressure on the other side in their negotiations to make political concessions as well as trade concessions.
Yep, that's what they do.
And back then, I remember Zoellick testifying to Congress. And he said that, and certainly in terms of Nicaragua and in the region generally, over 90% of the products entering the United States from Central America were already tariff free. So the actual
right.
benefits of CAFTA to the region were minimal, and essentially what they allowed, what it was a trade in your sovereignty agreement, whereby the Central American countries made huge concessions to the United States in terms of investment and preferences, and allowing U.S. investors to operate on the same terms as local businesses in the region. But the big thing for Nicaragua, and I don't think CAFTA's made a big difference to Nicaraguan agriculture. and you can argue about that, I suppose, that what it has made a big difference in is that because of Nicaragua's internal Zona Franca or Maquila regime, it's that Nicaragua has generated anything between 70 and 100,000 jobs in the maquila sector, which, you know, it may not be positive from a theoretical point of view, but in terms of people's employment, right, it's a massive consideration for people, sure, here in Nicaragua and also in the rest of the region.
Yeah.
So then we're looking at what happens with the NAFTA talks, because that'll give us some kind of idea of what the Central American countries can expect from Trump's negotiators if they go ahead and renegotiate CAFTA as well.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting also, particularly when you talk about Mexico, but also, some other trading partners like Colombia, for example, and some of the nations in the Caribbean, and Panama in Central America. You know, a large part of the business volume that's done with the U.S. and these other countries is off the books stuff. I mean, you have narco states in Colombia and Mexico, for example, offshore banking, money laundering and such, Panama, across the Caribbean, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You know, and those numbers are not part of the calculus, that we've been discussing so far. And I don't know that there are actual provisions for example, setting quotas on cocaine imports or whatever, or heroin imports under NAFTA or CAFTA or some of the other arrangements. But these are definitely very important and very powerful influences on the entire process, and they're almost never spoken of in that context.
Right. Oh, yeah. And the illicit economy is a huge source of income for the region and for the U.S. banking system.
For sure.
And I think, when was it, 3 years ago, 4 years ago? And there was a U.N. Statement from the U.N. Office that dealt with, that is responsible for kind of trying to coordinate policy, right, on anti-narcotics work. And they explicitly said that the United States banking system would suffer a very severe blow,
right,
if it was denied access to the money it launders from organized crime,
right,
drugs trafficking,
yep,
you know, people trafficking, which is also, yeah, an extremely lucrative business here, yep, and one of great concern to the authorities in the different countries in Central America.
Yep.
Because it has even more destructive, well, perhaps that's an exaggeration, but it has as destructive effects on society, people trafficking, as narcotics does.
And then there are multiple layers of people trafficking. That which is spoken of generally, you're talking about, you know, trading in children or young women or whatever for, you know, sex and physical labor, slavery and such. But when you have people forced to migrate for low paying jobs, that formerly had, a means of making a living. But that's been eradicated by, say, for example, NAFTA. And then you end up as an agricultural worker in the United States living as, part of a precariat. That is also human trafficking. You're trafficking in people over their labor, and perhaps you don't have a gun pointed at them to make them do what they want. But, starvation is also a pretty powerful weapon to wield, right, at people. So.
Right. Right. Yeah, so overall, United States policy throughout Mesoamerica, kind of Mexico, Central America, Panama, right down to Colombia and Colombia itself, has been incredibly destabilizing. And I sort of figure, and today I know on the Nodal website, in Mexico, a journalist is attacked every 15 hours.
Mm.
And so, and that's, And those kinds of statistics, and there are all kinds of statistics, but that one really jumped out at me because it means that anybody trying to describe the kind of disruption and destruction, the social and economic destruction that Mexico, for example, is suffering, you can't even write about it.
Right.
You
know? Well, you're at risk. Well, I wonder who the person was or the persons were that reported that.
Well, and yeah, and I think it was an official report from the Mexican authorities.
Right, but whoever published it, you know, in the media, I'm wondering where they were at 15 hours later.
Well, yeah, so and that kind of statistics, loads of statistics like that, I mean, about Mexico, 36,000 people disappeared.
Yeah, you know? I know, yeah.
And that maybe that's a cue to start talking about Venezuela.
Yeah, for sure. Yep.
When you look at those kinds of figures, it just makes mainstream media coverage and most alternative media coverage of events in the region that focus on Venezuela completely absurd. Mm. And if you look at that deep social and economic crisis in Mexico, and it's at least as serious, if not more serious, than the extremely difficult situation in Venezuela,
right?
Where you have had loss of life, but not as a result of general social breakdown, but as a deliberate policy by the Venezuelan opposition and their U.S. backers.
Right, that's right. Yeah, you have two different conditions. On the one hand, essentially government policy and U.S. foreign policy towards Mexico creates this failed state, in essence, a narco-terror state where people disappear by the, a busload of students, for example. We're still wondering where the 41 students were. You know, these things happen all the time. Journalists are attacked every 15 hours, yada, 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 yada. That's actual government policy, U.S. foreign policy at work. In Venezuela, the problems are also U.S. foreign policy at work in opposition to the government.
Yeah, and in Venezuela, and it's becoming clearer, with every day that goes by, it's becoming clearer and clearer that the decision by President Nicolas Maduro back in late May, early April, to call for elections to a constituent assembly has been extremely successful in terms of bringing some kind of stability to the country and forcing the extremely violent Venezuelan opposition, most of whose politicians hid behind they hid behind their legitimacy as elected representatives to the Venezuelan legislature, the National Assembly in Venezuela. They hid behind that and to conceal their role in supporting, encouraging a really very extreme violence that's been responsible for the loss of over 100 lives.
Yeah, and they were calling for a military coup and all kind, flying helicopters into the Supreme Court, you know, things like this.
Yeah, openly calling for U.S. intervention that they've now had to cycle, they're now backpedaling fiercely, trying to pretend, oh, it wasn't us.
Oops, I didn't say that. Yeah, right.
what Nicolas Maduro has done by successfully carrying out the elections, not just Nicolas Maduro, but all the Venezuelan authorities, bar the National Assembly, what they've achieved is they've made it impossible for the Venezuelan opposition, certainly inside Venezuela, to claim that they are falsely claim that they represent a majority of the Venezuelan people, because those elections to the Constituent Assembly in Venezuela clearly demonstrated a big majority in support of peace, attempts to reach peace and stability in Venezuela, and against the violent agenda of most of the Venezuelan opposition.
Yeah,
and it has to be said
they helped too, by the way. By calling their own vote a week before the official vote for the Constituent Assembly, They showed the world that, in essence, they have about half the following that the government has, because they had a turnout, according to their own estimate, which they couldn't prove, but they said there were about 4 million people that voted in theirs, and most people don't even believe that number, but that's what they claim, 4 million, and we know that more than 8 million voted with the government the week later. So they actually helped to demonstrate how weak they are in terms of popular support.
Yeah, and so, and I think some of the opposition leaders claimed 7 million, but most people and most independent observers reckoned it was 4 million. But anyway, at the most. But the other thing that the constituent assembly elections did was it forced the opposition's hand in terms of making them clearly state whether they were going to participate in the regional elections for. And I think I'm not sure how many governorships it is, and it's I think it's 19. It might be more than that. But the regional elections that were scheduled for December were for the governorships in Venezuela's different regions, and what the opposition did, the overall opposition, they registered a total of over 190 candidates for those elections. So I'm almost all by the tiny dissident political parties in the Venezuelan opposition have signed up for those elections. So what does that mean? It's very clear that implicitly they're recognizing the authority of the country's National Electoral Council, which is a separate power of state in Venezuela. And also, and that implies that they're recognizing the authority of the Constituent Assembly.
Right, that's right.
And the elections to the Constituent Assembly. Now, among the first decisions of the Constituent Assembly was to replace the Attorney General, the country's Attorney General, a woman called Luisa Ortega, who ever since March, really, has been very clearly taking decisions to encourage and support the Venezuelan opposition's campaign against the legitimately elected government of Nicolas Maduro and against the National Assembly. Now, it turns out that she's been accused now. One of the first decisions of the Constituent Assembly was to replace her on the grounds that of negligence and not doing what she constitutionally swore to do, and on the basis of downright lies on her part, where she claimed that she hadn't signed off on the appointment of some magistrates and judicial officials in Venezuela, when in fact she had, and it was proved that she had. And in the wake of that decision by the National Assembly to appoint a new Attorney General, the new Attorney General opened an investigation into a corruption scandal, whereby they're accusing Luisa Ortega and many of her colleagues that have now been removed from the public prosecutor, the Attorney General's office, of extorting money from people that they were investigating over the last couple of years.
Right.
So, and now she's fled the country.
Yeah, she was in Colombia. I'm wondering how long before she shows up in Miami.
Well, the fact that she's left the country, makes it look very, very bad for her. And she's obviously going to claim political persecution, right?
Oh, yeah. The stories are positioned like Al Jazeera. Luisa Ortega, fearing for her life, flees to Colombia, and here's in the Telegraph in the UK. Deposed Venezuelan prosecutor flees country in dramatic speedboat escape.
Yeah, and I have no idea of the details, but the nitty gritty is that if she's left the country, she's probably guilty as hell.
Yeah,
because it's absurd to suggest that her physical safety was in any way in danger from certainly from the Venezuelan authorities, and maybe from her own side, the Venezuelan opposition. But time will tell how that story pans out. But that was a very important decision by the Constituent Assembly, and it means that the authorities in Venezuela have now been able to recover their control over that very, very important office. Imagine if the Attorney General in the United States and kind of turned out to be somebody completely opposed to the president and acted in a way, you know, it just wouldn't happen in the United States because everybody's bought off at that kind of level, way or another.
Yeah, right. That's right.
But, you know.
Well, you're kind of seeing that happen, actually, with in the Trump administration is that kind of contradiction, because it's unusual, though. But, you know, one of the things with her was she also attacked the Supreme Court. Now, the Attorney General attacking the Supreme Court is that's about as, you know, as ridiculous as it gets. That's the they're supposed to be working, you know, towards the same ends in one fashion or another. And she instead, you know, the Supreme Court was. And they barred her from leaving the country in June and froze her assets because of misconduct.
Right. Yes, the other thing about that the opposition have got, they've got a story circulating in the international media that the Constituent Assembly has either dissolved the existing legislature or else has stripped it of its powers. And neither of those stories are true. What none of these reports include is that Venezuela's National Assembly has been in defiance of the Supreme Court, a Supreme Court ruling ever since the 2015 legislative elections,
which the
opposition won by a mile. And there were three deputies that were elected under very irregular circumstances, with strong allegations of vote buying and other irregularities.
Right, fraud.
And what the Supreme Court in Venezuela said was, well, you can't, those three deputies can't take their seats in the National Assembly.
Right.
But the legislature ignored that ruling from the Supreme Court and swore in those three deputies to the National Assembly, and that meant that all their decisions have been null since then. And the National Assembly itself has disqualified itself
by refusing
to submit to the authority of the Supreme Court. It's as if the people in the United States said, well, doesn't matter what the Supreme Court rules, we're going to do what we want.
Yeah, in other words, let's say that three members of the U.S. Senate, you know, their elections were successfully challenged in the court system, and the court said, you know, you need another election, these people were not, you know, can't be seated, and the members of the Senate said, forget that, and they had them in, and they deliberate, and they vote, and, you know, they act as full members, the court would say, sorry, you know, that act is illegitimate, you acted outside of your powers, outside of your constitutional authority, etc. And we'll come back to that next week when we you know, go through some of the other things, because there are some other related issues that I really want to work. It's just that we're out of time now. And so, Tony, thank you very much for your time, as usual.
You're very welcome, Tony. It's good to have a chance to talk about this stuff.
Absolutely. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.